calling the Senate Labor and Commerce Committee to order for March 29th, 2011. And today we will be hearing four bills. Two we have already heard. Senate Bill 78, Liquor License Holder Liability, will be up number one. And then House Bill 28, Temporary License Fee Waiver for Professionals. And then two new bills, Senate Bill 100, PERS Termination Costs, and House Bill 13, Workers' Compensation for Medical Fees. And first off, we have Senator Giesel, Senator Menard, Senator Pasquin, and myself, Senator Egan, Chair. And first bill we will, and I apologize for my cold, first bill we will hear, Senate Bill 78, Liquor License Holder Liability. And Ms. Temple, you can come.
Senator Davis.
And Senator Davis has arrived as well, so we have a full committee. And thank you for showing up. I'm sorry, Ms. Temple.
For the record, my name is Esther Temple, and I'm staff to Senator Liesel McGuire. And you have already heard Senate Bill 78 previously, and I'm just here to answer any questions and or concerns you may have.
Thank you, Ms. Temple. Questions from the committee? What's the committee's pleasure?
Mr. Chair, I move that we advance Senate Bill number 78 from this committee to the next committee of referral with individual recommendations and attached zero fiscal note.
Great. Thank you, Senator Pasquin. We'll take a brief adios. Okay, we will reconvene the Labor and Commerce Committee for March 29th. Back to order next on our agenda, House Bill 28, Temporary License Fee Waivers for Professionals. Do we have somebody in the audience? Ms. Schroeder, are you ready to testify? Thank you.
Thank you, Mr. Chairman. For the record, Casey Schroeder Hodge, staff representative Thomas, and you heard the bill last week, and I'm just here for questions.
For the questions from the committee, for Ms. Schroeder. Senator Pasquin.
Yes, Mr. Chair, I believe that there is an amendment that is a friendly amendment that I would like to bring before the committee. So at this time, I would move that we bring amendment number one, identified as version 27G-1, before this committee for purposes of discussion.
for the committee.
Yes.
I object for purposes of discussion, sorry. Questions?
Could Casey go through it, explain the reasoning and...
Mr. Chairman, I'd love to do that. However, the department is here, and this is by request of the department, and it's strictly a cleanup amendment, and so I would defer all questions and comments to the department.
Great. Thank you, Casey. And if you can identify yourself for the record, please.
Thank you, Mr. Chairman. My name is Sarah Chambers. I am the Program Coordinator for Professional Licensing within the Division of Corporations, Business, and Professional Licensing in the Department of Commerce. This amendment would establish a 120-day period in which to license those eligible for the state's new pawnbroker licensing program. SB 292, last year's legislation relating to the registration and operation of pawnbrokers, allowed no window of time between the effective date of pawnbroker regulations and the effective licensing date of affected parties. A 120-day temporary license would allow an opportunity for those required to be licensed under the new statute to become fully licensed in an efficient manner that provides ample opportunity for due diligence to be performed. Those affected could become temporarily licensed and continue to legally operate following the July 1st effective date of regulations, providing the department ample time to notice licensing information to all known interested parties and legally accept payments for licensure, and allow time for potential licensees to ask questions and gather documentation required for initial licensure. Without this change, licensees would need to become licensed before regulations would come into effect, rendering such an event impossible.
Okay, thank you, Ms. Chambers. Question for Ms. Chambers. And just for the committee, we just received this amendment from the Department of Law. That's why it doesn't look normal. We haven't received it back from legislative drafting yet. So that's why it looks... Senator Giesel.
And understanding that, Mr. Chair, I just would point out that on line 7 of the amendment, it says Section 2, and actually it would be Section 3. There's already a Section 2 in the bill on the bottom of page 2. So that's just a little drafting thing. But I didn't have any questions about the content or rationale. Thank you.
Thank you, Senator, for pointing that out.
Mr. Chairman, are we still working off this work draft, Chief?
We're working on Senate CS for CS for House Bill 28 and with an amendment.
I have the amendment. I'm saying, is this corresponding with G?
Correct.
It says work draft.
Yes.
So, okay.
Yes. Further questions for Ms. Chambers? And you've noted the change that we'll make, and thank you, Senator Giesel, for pointing that out. We do have Mark Sansuki, Department of...
Who's going to do the amendment?
Department of Defense here to answer questions, just in case. We have questions of the Department of Defense. Senator Pascan.
I'll withdraw
my objection.
So based upon that, I move that we advance the Senate CS for CS for House Bill 28 as amended by Amendment Number 1, identified 27G-1, from this committee to the next committee of referral with individual recommendations and attached fiscal note, if any.
Okay, thanks, Senator Pasban. Further discussion? We'll take a brief at ease. Labor and Commerce for March 29th. And the next bill will be Senate Bill 100. This will be the first piece of testimony we've had on Senate Bill 100. PERS termination cause, sponsor Senator Pascvan, and will be presented by Jeff Steff of staff.
Anyway, Mr. Chair, I would move that we bring Senate Bill 100 version / D before this committee for purposes of discussion.
Senator Pascvan.
Yes, the purpose of Senate Bill 100, and it arises out of my contact with a friend of mine, Mr. Michael Lamb, who is the chief financial officer of the Fairbanks North Star Borough. And we were discussing this problem that exists when a borough tries to be flexible in their programs, and they may want to do something for a couple of years and then transition to a different type of program. And the question is when they have the transfer of those employees potentially from one program to another, there's this termination study and the costs burden that can be applied even if there is no change in the overall number of employees of a particular municipality or school district. And so in short, as a result of that, I presented a Senate bill a year ago to deal with this. It quickly became apparent that the details of this were pretty significant. And anyway, the bottom line of it all is that Michael Lamb is here to present, or Mr. Stepp would, yeah, Mr. Lamb.
Mr. Stepp and Mr. Lamb, would you both like to come forward?
Just Mr. Lamb.
Or just Mr. Lamb?
Yeah. Mr. Lamb is
Mr.
the...
Mr. Stepp gets off?
He gets off.
Okay. So.
Anyway, Mr. Lamb, if...
Mr. Lamb, come forward, please. And your name and affiliation for the record, please.
Thank you.
Mr. Chairman, members of the committee, for the record, my name is Michael Lamb. I'm a certified public accountant and a certified government financial manager. I am the chief financial officer for the Fairbanks North Star Borough. I am the president of the board of the Alaska Municipal League Investment Pool, and I'm also co-chair of AML's Revenue Finance Subcommittee. I have over 21 years as a chief financial officer here in Alaska, and I have invested over the last six or so years an inordinate amount of time studying, explaining, and working on PERS-TERS issues. I'm actually uncomfortable ever claiming to be an expert on or about anything, but I feel most respectfully that I've earned the right to have my knowledge of and about PERS recognized and my understanding and knowledge of this specific PERS issue recognized and acknowledged. And again, I make that point most respectfully, but it is why, with explicit permission of the AML Executive Director, that I can state that my comments and testimony represent not only my views and position, represent the views and position of the Fairbanks North Star Borough, but also, and importantly, they represent the views and position of the Alaska Municipal League, which has about 140 municipal members. Common courtesy, of course, dictates that I thank you for the opportunity to testify to this committee on how crucial PERS employers feel getting Senate Bill 100 passed into law this session is. Given the very real press of time for legislative action this session, my comments today are going to be purposely direct. I'm going to be as transparent as I can be in conveying why AML member employers feel that there exists a compelling need to adopt a disciplined and an exactly focused limited change to those parts of state law that order termination studies. Very simply, because of the shall language in state statutes, regulatory action cannot fix the problems I'm going to explain to you today. Regulation cannot override statutory directives, thus the need for this legislative fix to a few detrimental and unanticipated consequences of certain language adopted in Senate Bill 125. Let me commence by addressing three significant questions that some may have about Senate Bill 100. but these relevant questions addressed, you can cast them from your minds, and I can focus my time on why passage of Senate Bill 100 is so critical and compelling. Number one, first and foremost, let me convey with no ambiguity at all, Senate Bill 100 has absolutely nothing, nothing, and nothing to do with the defined benefit DB versus defined contribution, the DC issue. That controversy, that discussion, as real as it is, and I acknowledge that, has no place and should be given no standing when considering Senate Bill 100. For purposes of Senate Bill 100, the DB versus DC issue is not relevant, period, other than to create and foster fear when any PERS legislation is under consideration. Let us not let fear rule the day or impede our doing the correct and proper thing, what is so demanded and is so clearly obvious. Secondly, it is the view and formal position of AML PERS member employers that their desire and their respectful, I use the word respectful, request to legislators is that there be no amendments made to Senate Bill 100. It is exacting in what it accomplishes and should be adopted exactly as drafted. Should Senate Bill 100 be used to hang any amendment to it for any purpose? Absolutely and unequivocally no. It is a single issue focused bill to fix a specific problem, and it should be left untainted by any other legislative issues. Thirdly, and let me say with clarity and purpose, that my integrity and my reputation and my credibility are sacred to me, and I stand as a vanguard to them, always. And knowing that this is what is so, if I were asked, are PERS employers trying to sidestep their obligation to help pay down the unfunded obligation, or ask, is or has Senate Bill 100 been in any way constructed or intended to be used for this purpose, I unequivocally say no. I guess I would also say with some confidence that no one has talked or communicated with more people and or communities on this issue in this state than me. And I say to you, not in one conversation, not in one email, and not in one letter relating to the termination study issues has it ever been discussed in any way, shape, or form that PERS employers could sidestep their financial obligation or shift any PERS funding responsibilities to the state through or by this legislation. Senate Bill 100 is not about DB versus DC. Senate Bill 100 should not have any amendments attached to it. And Senate Bill 100 is and was not in any way designed to let PERS employers, boroughs, cities, school district, and the state as a PERS employer sidestep their obligation to share in paying down the unfunded obligation. And for the record, and it's with conviction that I state and remind everyone that the Alaska State Legislature in Senate Bill 125 helped Alaska's PERS employers tremendously by adopting the flat statutory 22% rate. It brought predictability, affordability, and it brought stability to the employer's rate. Legislators in crafting Senate Bill 125 struggled hard to come up with a fair and equitable solution to a problem that most of them did not create. Further, but most importantly, and in fact, the very reason we are here today is that in crafting Senate Bill 125, legislators never envisioned, intended, nor did they want to create any inequitable financial damage to any PERS member employer, nor negatively interfere with the current or future delivery of any member services or programs, which of course the termination study law clearly and conclusively does. In an extract from a communication from Marvin Smith, who's the manager of Bristol Bay, to Senator Hoffman and Representative Eggman regarding Senate Bill 100, we strongly support this bill. He says, presently, the Bristol Bay Borough has decided not to add any new positions or delete any positions until this issue is resolved. Therefore, our government cannot expand or shrink as good management should be allowed to do. 2 AAC 35-235, Calculation of Termination Cost states, A, an employer that proposes to terminate coverage of a department, group, or other classification of employee, or terminate participation of the employer, must have a termination study completed by the plan actuary to determine the actuarial cost of the employer for future benefits due employees whose coverage is terminated. Let me repeat. It says for future benefits due employees whose coverage is terminated. DC defined contribution employees have no future actuarial cost. Further, B says, in addition to the cost calculated in A, the employer is required to pay to the plan until the past service liability of the plan is extinguished, an amount calculated by applying the current past service rate adopted by the board to salaries of the term employees. This payment shall be made each payroll period. Accordingly, and here's the problem, if a PERS employer, as Senator Pascavan mentioned in his opening comments, if a PERS employer reduces its employee count because it made a decision to alter or suspend one of its programs or services, or simply move some of its human resources to where they're most needed, in some cases by even a single position, such as a single disaster response coordinator at a school district, then per 2AAC 35235, PERS very possibly will send that employer three bills. The first bill will be for the cost of doing an actual termination study, $2,500 to maybe $5,000. The second bill will be what the study says you owe the system due to the employee changes you made. And the third bill, the big bill, is the one that says that will require the employer to pay the past service cost on each of the position salaries the PERS said you needed to opt out of PERS. And currently that's 18.63 until the unfunded obligation is paid off, maybe 30 years from now. Interestingly, as I read about the assumptions used in the termination calculations, I, like Larry Simmons, who has a great deal of understanding of the system, was on the ARM board, wonder if the past service liability ever actually gets extinguished, essentially making these termination payments perpetual payments on the backs of PERS employers. They could essentially never go away. These three bills cumulatively can run from hundreds of thousands of dollars to several millions of dollars per each and every termination study incident. The underlying fear that certain PERS employers would purposely act in a manner that jeopardized payment of the unfunded obligation and thus shrink the salary base that pays the unfunded obligation, simply it has not happened. The total PERS salary base must be sustained and have reasonable growth, which it has, to the tune of about 19.5% since 6/30/08 when the floor was set. It's important to absorb and digest the fact that the statutes already have a salary-based floor that all PERS employers must pay the 22% on, even if they completely exited the system. Senate Bill 100 actually, statutorily, reinforces this obligation by its amendment to Section 1 of AS 39-35-255, which added a new subsection I that reads, after an employer's participation in the plan terminates with regard to some or all of the employer's employees who are active members of the system, the employer remains obligated to make contributions under A of this section, which is 22% times the current, the greater of 22% times your current salary or the 63008 floor, until the plan does not have a past service liability. The future stability of PERS employers and their ability to efficiently and effectively manage the delivery of their programs and services is being directly and negatively impacted and undermined by 2AAC 35-235. What is exceedingly frustrating for all other PERS employers, except for the state, is that equitable and consistent application of the state's termination law does not seem to be occurring, nor likely can it ever occur given the uniqueness of all PERS employers' positions. A law like this that has such a material financial impact on PERS employers should, at a minimum, be able to be fairly, equitably, and consistently applied to all PERS employers. Yet the Division of Retirement Benefits has taken the position that the state, with half of the PERS salary base, $1 billion of a $2 billion annual salary base, is exempt from termination studies and their financial impacts. A simple straight-line calculation of the unfunded tells you that one-half of the obligation must belong to the state. But the state, as a PERS employer, the biggest PERS employer isn't subject to that portion of the law per retirement benefits. The state is subject to the 63008 portion of the law for retirement benefits, but not the termination portion of the law. And this significantly disturbs other PERS employers. And I have to say, that is an understatement. No attorney that I've talked with, and there have been many, has found any such written exception or exclusion in the law. Just as concerning is the fact that the termination language inescapably creates an inequitable impact on small PERS employers. This state law, or its application by PERS, creates a clear and unconscionable impact on small PERS employers versus large PERS employers. Many smaller communities only have one employee for a program or a service. If they lose a grant or simply are faced with budget constraints and they have to cut a person, say their only nurse in their school, then they'd be required to have a termination study done. Then pay all of the related costs because they actually cut a function or a group by a single person. A large employer could cut 10 nurses, but as long as they kept at least one nurse employed, no termination study. A 10-to-1 impact on the PERS salary base, but only the small school district gets financially impacted and punished by the current law. If we want to drive some of our very limited education dollars right out of the classroom, then keep the law the way it is. Senate Bill 100 effectively helps keep education dollars in the classroom. Amazingly, and contrary to good public policy, termination studies negatively impact our decision and our ability to accept grants because of their potential future termination study liability. Grant-funded positions may become subject to the termination studies once the positions are terminated due to grant funding ending, even if they were brand new DC employees hired with those grant funds. Reading a little extract from a communication between Larry Simmons, who is the city manager for Soldotna and Retirement Benefits, on March 1, Larry poses a question. The city of Soldotna recently received a grant to fund a new police position for 3 years. Part of the grant application was to create a lieutenant position. The city has not had this position previously. My concern is that at the end of the four-year period, if the city is unable to fund the position and eliminates the lieutenant's position, the city will be on the hook for a termination study and paying the past service liability rate for an unlimited time period on this position, which didn't come into existence until fiscal year 2011. I base this on my assumption the Department of Division of Retirement Benefits would determine that the single position constitutes a group since it is the only position with the title lieutenant. In response to that question, a response was sent back on March 7th to Mr. Simmons, and it says, I see from your email the city of Soldotna chose, which was underlined, chose to pursue grant funding for a new police position and have created a lieutenant position as part of that grant application. You are correct that if this lieutenant position is the only one in the city, then it constitutes the only of its classification. If the position created is PERS eligible and the city's participation agreement is not amended to exclude it from PERS, termination costs will be calculated when the city removes it from PERS. Taking advantage of grant opportunities to improve services to the public is a decision for local officials to make for themselves. Part of that decision process must include consideration whether the positions resulting from the grant should or should not be included in PERS. Our recommendation for any position which has uncertain future funding is that it not be placed in the PERS. Employers could find themselves paying the past service cost rate on former grant-funded position salaries with and from other finite revenues once those grant-funded positions are ended. It is amazing to me that retirement benefits suggest excluding grant-funded positions from PERS as its solution to this problem. Why would we, as a policy, seek to minimize or reduce the total salary base used to pay down the unfunded obligation by excluding grant salary dollars? That solution is 180 degrees off course. We ought to be finding every grant dollar we can and do all we can to be sure as many dollars as is reasonably possible are salary dollars helping to pay down the unfunded obligation. What is surprising as well is that there are no offsets taken into account for salary increases in one area for decreases in another area. In other words, the ability for entities to adjust their programs and services to meet their constituents' needs is negatively impacted by the current law. If an employer needs to cut in Area A and add over here in Area B, that employer could find itself paying the past service cost rate times the salary it is no longer paying over here in Area A because it shifted its employees from here over to Area B where there's more need, now, whether that need was driven by local requirements or by a mandate. Essentially, the same salary dollars that we just shifted from here over to here could be billed not only at the 22%, but the 18% past service cost rate on top of the 22 for an effective PERS rate of 40% on those salaries. In a communication from Retirement Benefits to Mr. Stepp, Senator Pascavan aide, on February 14th, the division promised Senator Pascavan a response today regarding our review and analysis of AS 3935625 and AS 3935255. We have completed our review and we recognize and agree that the construction of the two statutes would result in employers being double charged contributions on salaries of employees for whom coverage is terminated. I can't imagine any legislator wanted this outcome. Senate Bill 100 fixes this travesty. There is no regulatory authority to fix or override the statutes for this issue. Once you start shifting employee resources from one area of responsibility to another, and you start paying 22% plus 18% past service cost rate, you start a negative downward spiraling in our programs and services delivery. The consequences of the termination study is that it effectively nullifies the intent of Senate Bill 125, which was that employers pay the exact same rate. It is clear that one of these termination studies, is that different employers will in fact be paying different net rates, and therefore there will not be a single uniform contribution rate for all PERS employers. The adoption of Senate Bill 125 was based on the acknowledgement that we had that we did not have a single agent multiple employer system, but rather we actually had a consolidated but unequitable cost share system. The intent of Senate Bill 125 was that all employers would pay the exact same rate. That cannot happen when each employer pays different termination cost amounts or they pay none at all. It is clear that all PERS employers support a sustainable salary base to pay off the PERS unfunded obligation. It is also, though, crystal clear that the termination language in Senate Bill 125 was a solution to a problem that never materialized and it is not needed. The negative consequences, the additional charges, and the payments that result from the termination language were never contemplated or intended by the legislature, and they are destructive and they are clearly divisive. Mr. Chairman, committee members, AS 3935625, which requires termination studies, and any other similar statute or regulation should be repealed, which is precisely what and only what Senate Bill 100 accomplishes, which is why myself, the borough, and all 140 AML members unequivocally support the adoption and passage of Senate Bill 100 in this legislative session. Let me reiterate my original 3 points. One, this bill has nothing to do with the DB versus DC nothing. Two, the AML most respectfully opposes any amendments or add-ons to this bill. And three, this bill does not allow PERS employers to sidestep their obligation to share in paying down unfunded obligation. It in fact clarifies and it puts into law that the obligation and the 630.08 floor exist until there is no past service cost left in the system. But additionally, and on the positive side, it allows for fair, consistent, and equitable treatment under law for all of the PERS employers. It remedies the financial injustice done to smaller employers wherein the same set of circumstances and fact patterns are of no consequence to a larger employer. It corrects and reaffirms our grants acceptance policy, which states that grant dollars provide benefit to the PERS system rather than further damaging the system by having a policy that promotes minimizing the acceptance of grant salary dollars. It restores the PERS employer's ability to manage and adjust their programs and services to meet the needs of those they serve and those that can force mandates upon them by removing the obligation to double pay PERS costs when salaries are shifted between services or programs. Mr. Chairman, members of the committee, and all the members of the legislature for that matter, it's my very great hope that you have heard my words and my message today. I sought to be direct and transparent and to offend no one, and I most graciously apologize if I did. Many have worked hard on the legislation before this body today and on the other PERS legislation already adopted and in place today, and I most respectfully acknowledge those efforts and that work, and I say thank you. But at the end of the day, we, and I mean collectively we, failed to get one piece of the final Senate Bill 125 legislation right. And I'm doing my part right now to correct where I failed. I failed in my foresight to consider the termination study impacts resulting from some of the language in Senate Bill 125. For my part, my apologies. I missed it. Accordingly, if I can do anything to assist this body in adopting Senate Bill 100 as quickly as possible, wherein all employers will stay fiscally viable and be able to continue to provide their programs and services, I stand ready to assist in any way I can. Senator Pascavan, thank you for the display of statesmanship you have shown in bringing forth this very precise bill to fix a very precise problem. Your actions have not gone unnoticed by PERS employers. Mr. Chairman and committee members, thank you for the opportunity to speak today, and thank you kindly for your time today, and not meaning or intending to be presumptive in any manner, I do thank you in advance for your support of this bill and for moving it forward for ultimate passage and signing by the governor. Mr. Chairman, that concludes my comments.
Great. Thank you very much, Mr. Lamb, and thank you very much for presenting SB 100 on behalf of Senator Pascavan. I just want to recognize also Representative Kurt Olson, the Chair of House Labor and Commerce. Representative Olson, welcome to our hearing room today. We do have folks signed up to testify. However, do we have questions for Mr. Lamb? Michael, thank you very much for your testimony.
Mr. Chair.
We do have a number of people that would like to testify on this legislation. And because of the lateness of the committee hearing, we're going to try to limit your testimony to 3 minutes maximum. And Larry Simmons, manager of the city of Soldotna, maybe Mr. Lamb gave your testimony, but if you would like to add anything, Mr. Simmons?
Thank you, Mr. Chairman and members of the committee. I would like to testify.
And I'm sorry, if you can give your name and affiliation for the record, please.
Yes. My name is Larry Simmons. I'm the city manager of the city of Soldotna. And like my knowledgeable colleague, Mr. Lamb, I'm a certified public accountant. He mentioned that I was on the ARM board when it was created. And I want to say that I was very involved in the process of adopting Senate Bill 125 in 2007 and 2008. Given this involvement, I am somewhat embarrassed to say that I was not aware of how these termination studies were going to work until the Division of Retirement and Benefits adopted their regulations and began enforcing the law. And frankly, I was shocked. I disagreed. I argued with the two people at DRB that they were misinterpreting the law, that their regulations didn't comport with the law, but I'm now convinced, as Mr. Lamb is, that it requires a statutory change. I'm very concerned about the impact of the law, particularly on small municipalities or school districts. The law apparently requires a termination study to be conducted at any time a department, group, or other classification that was paying into the system for any reason stops paying into the system. In small municipalities, a group is often made up of a single position, Consequently, if for budgetary reasons a municipality or school district does not fund a position, they will be required to pay the state's actuary to conduct a termination study, pay the resulting cost identified in the termination study, and pay the past service rate contribution on the salary for decades. And this is critical, even though there's no continuing salary. To me, this is absurd, and it makes it impossible for PERS employer members to manage staffing levels. I do want to draw to your attention that Senate Bill 100 does not eliminate termination studies entirely. If a member employer terminates all participation in the plan, that employer will be required to conduct a termination study and pay the resulting cost. And employers are still required to pay their fair share under Senate Bill 100 in that the 2008 salary floor is still in place. This was the provision that was intended to prohibit a PERS employer from escaping their obligation for unfunded liability of the system. Setting a floor for contribution calculation ensures that one employer is not going to contract out a significant portion of their operation, thus reducing salary and thus avoiding to pay their fair share of the debt. Mr. Lamb's testimony was excellent. I also am shocked that the Division of Retirement and Benefits considers the state, which is the largest member of PERS, to be exempt from these regulations. Frankly, all large employers are minimally impacted because typically they have larger departments or larger groups of employees and can eliminate positions without eliminating an entire group. Clearly, the financial impact on the system is greater by a large entity like the state leaving many positions vacant or eliminating many positions than a small municipality or school district eliminating a single position. But if that single position constitutes a group, the impact on the employer can be in the many hundreds of thousands of dollars. How can it be right that a position can be eliminated in one organization with no devastating impacts due to PERS obligations, but in another organization, the impact is huge? I'll skip my my part on our lieutenant position and cut to the end here. Soldotna supports paying down the unfunded liability and agree that we need to pay our fair share. But this termination cost requirement and its resultant cost goes far beyond paying our fair share. It's extremely punitive to small municipalities and school districts from a financial perspective, and it makes it impossible to properly manage staffing levels. I want to say that I'm hopeful that the State Department of Administration recognizes these problems and will get on board with resolving this issue. I could go on at some length. As Mr. Lamb, I've spent an inordinate amount of time in the last number of years dealing with PERS issues. I'm happy to have done it, however, and I'm willing to continue to do it. So please contact me if you want to discuss this from a practitioner standpoint. I ask that you work swiftly on the bill and pass it out of your committee, and thank you very much for allowing me to speak.
Great. Thank you, Mr. Simmons. Questions for the manager? Seeing none, thank you again for your testimony this afternoon. Next, we have off-net Mark Lynch, City Manager of Cordova. Mr. Lynch, are you available?
Yes, I am.
Great. Welcome, and your name and affiliation for the record, please.
This is Mark Lynch, for the record, City Manager of the City of Cordova. I'm not sure that, for the sake of time, I'll not go into a lot of detail. I think Mr. Lamb and Mr. Simmons have covered the issues primarily that are of concern to Cordova. I would reiterate that the city understands that there's an unfunded liability to be paid and that we need to pay our fair share on that. Again, that's not a part of this. The concern, the way that I look at it is I just need to be able to manage personnel, to make personnel decisions that are in the best interest of the community. And some of these issues, Mr. Lamb pointed out the issue of double paying or double charging on certain positions, and a lot of times it's not clear, and I need to have some clarity in the law so that I can know when I'm hiring that I'm not going to end up somewhere down the road paying both a past service liability and a current PERS retirement fee on the same individual or on the same position. One thing I'll say, and I'll close fairly quickly here. As I said, Mr. Lamb and Mr. Simmons are extremely knowledgeable. I've had a number of discussions with them, and I trust their knowledge on this topic. But I did have our city law firm look into this a little bit for me as well, because I wanted to have another view on it. And I would just say here that our attorney responded to me, and I quote, she said, "I have analyzed the PERS termination studies," and then I'll jump to the end, essentially. Near the end of her comments, she said, "I honestly believe that PERS believes that statute provides it with a right to hold cities on the hook indefinitely for any position that is terminated from PERS." And then very near the end, she said, "In other words, I believe the picture is likely as bleak as Mr. Lamb has painted it." So she reviewed this in some detail, and her conclusion was that for those that have read the termination study document that Mr. Lamb presented, I believe it's been given to everyone at the legislature, that her conclusion was that it's accurate, that what he is telling is, in fact, the situation as it exists today, and that communities, especially smaller communities like Cordova, need to have this change made in the law so that we can properly manage our personnel. And I want to thank the committee and the chairman. I want to thank Ms. Senator Pascvan for the bill, and that concludes my comments.
Great. Thank you very much, Mr. Lynch. Questions for Mr. Lynch? Mark, again, thank you very much for taking the time to testify this afternoon. Next, we have online John Bowling for the City of Craig. John, are you online?
I am, Mr. Chairman.
Great. Thank you. Name and affiliation for the record, please.
My name is John Bowling. I'm the City Administrator for the City of Craig. We're a first-class municipality with a population, according to the latest U.S. Census figures, of 1,201 persons. Mr. Chairman, I'm here to speak in support of SB 100. The City of Craig is caught up in these very difficult PERS-related circumstances with two departments here locally, and the financial impact of those changes without the changes recommended under Senate Bill 100 are going to be very difficult for us. We're a longstanding PERS employer. We intend to remain that way. But the current regulation and statute are going to take a heavy toll on us, as well as a number of other PERS employers in Alaska, and would encourage the committee to debate and then move forward out of committee, Senate Bill 100. Thank you, Mr. Chairman.
Great. Thank you very much for your brief testimony, Mr. Bowling. Questions for the city administrator? Seeing none, great. Thank you very much for sticking around this afternoon. Next, we have Patrick Cole, City of Fairbanks. Mr. Cole.
Yes, Mr. Chairman, it's Patrick Cole, City of Fairbanks. I'm the Chief of Staff here. Our Mayor, Jerry Cleaver, was unavailable today to testify, but he wanted me to pass on to you that we support Senate Bill 100. We greatly appreciate the work done by Mr. Lamb, Mr. Simmons, the Senator Pascvan, and the staff. And with that, I'll conclude my testimony. Thank you again for all your work, and we are greatly thankful for this bill.
Great. Thank you very much, Mr. Cole, and we appreciate your brevity. Questions for Mr. Cole? See none. Next to testify, Danielle Fegley, Municipality of Anchorage.
Yes, for the record, my name is Danielle Fegley, Acting Director of Employee Relations for the Municipality of Anchorage.
Well, welcome.
Well, thank you for allowing me the opportunity to comment on Senate Bill 100. The Municipality of Anchorage supports this bill, and reinforcing this position is our experience with the weatherization program here. The MLA decided not to renew a state grant for providing weatherization services. Instead, we arranged for another entity to resume the responsibility for administering the program. Some of the employees moved into other jobs, and others were relocated to this new entity. When we began that process of eliminating the positions associated with this grant, we learned of the possibility of an ongoing financial obligation for the unfunded PERS liability. The liability has a cost, a potential of reaching and exceeding $5 million. And The MOA supports the changes to restore an equitable process that maintains a sustainable salary base currently described in the existing legislation without having, you know, this termination study that was in place. So in summary, you know, just to keep things short, you know, the municipality of Anchorage is supporting this legislation for the following reasons. This legislation maintains a sustainable salary base. It creates a flexible workforce that is responsive to market conditions and available funds. It applies an equitable treatment across participating employers, both large and small. And overall, it simplifies the administration costs and is easily enforceable. And for those reasons, in conclusion, the municipality is supporting this bill. Thank you.
Great. Thank you very much, Ms. Fegley. Questions for Ms. Fegley? Seeing none, thank you very much for sticking around for your testimony this afternoon. Next is Deanne Woodruff, representing herself. I hope I have this pronounced correctly. Ms. Woodruff, are you online?
Yes, I'm here.
Great, thank you. If you can state your affiliation for the record, please, and name. And go ahead with your testimony.
I am a member of the West Silla City Council, but I believe that you received official comments from our finance director today. I just want to add a little bit to that. I am also a CPA and have had the pleasure of sitting in on Mr. Lamb's committee with the Alaska Municipal League. I want to let you know that I, as an individual, absolutely support this bill, and I support it seeing what it has as an effect in my community. It is inequitable for small communities, but it is not without impact on larger ones like Wasilla. We find ourselves in the same position that Cordova does regarding the hiring of a temporary police chief in the form of a retired Alaska State Trooper. And we are also looking at a program for which we may receive reduced grant funding, which may cause us to reduce that program and take it, eliminate it altogether. If we, in fact, do eliminate that, then we are in the same boat as the smaller communities with a smaller number of folks who are being eliminated due to the lack of a grant. So I just want to keep it pretty brief, but I really appreciate all of the work that Mr. Lamb has done. I appreciate the conversations I've been able to have with Mr. Simmons and Mr. Lynch regarding the situation that we are in Wasilla, and I really want to thank the committee and Senator Pascaven for allowing me to testify on this, and I concur with everything that I've heard so far today, and just urge passage of this bill, and hope that you will see fit to move it forward.
Great.
I believe it is counterproductive and has some unintended consequences.
Great. Thank you very much, Ms. Woodruff. Questions from the committee for Ms. Woodruff? Thank you very much again, Diane, for sticking around and testifying this afternoon. And we have one more on off-net, Jim Dinley of Sitka. Mr. Dinley.
Yes, this is Jim Dinley, municipal administrator for the city and borough of Sitka. And I want to thank the chairman and the committee members for the opportunity to testify today. City and borough requests that you pass the SB 100 termination bill as it's written without amendment. The future of applying for grants to offer programs to local citizens is in jeopardy if a termination study is required upon layoff of personnel paid by the grant. A termination study would negatively impact Sitka's decision and our ability to accept grants because of the potential future liability. Sitka currently has two personnel-related grants on the books, and I have great reservations, and I don't want to take the risk to accept these positions under the present scenario. We could find ourselves paying for past service cost rates on former grant-funded positions. It just is too great a risk for a smaller city to accept these grants with no continuation of any future grant money. The City and Borough of Sitka support certainly what Mr. Lamb and Larry Simmons have testified. We're fully in support of it. I guess my concern is I would have great reservations in accepting a PERS-related grant in the future, and I don't think that was the intent of the legislation, and we would urge and ask your favorable support to vote yes on SB 100. And I thank you and the committee for allowing me to testify.
Great. Thank you very much, Mr. Dinley, for your testimony. Questions from the committee for Mr. Dinley? Great. Okay. And we do have one more. The printer has had a slight problem. However, we have Marv, I hope this is correct, Marv Smith representing Bristol Bay. Mr. Smith, are you online?
Yes, sir.
Great.
Thank you.
Your name and affiliation for the record, please, and provide your testimony.
Thank you, sir. Yes, sir. My name is Marv Smith. I'm the manager of Bristol Bay Borough, Nyack, Alaska, and I'm the human resource person for the borough as a borough manager also. Thank you for the opportunity to testify through the chair and members of the board. This PERS determination study, definitely Senate Bill 100 needs to be passed. Our borough currently is, we're a very small government, and we have decided this year not to add any new positions based on the fact that our whole economy is based on the fishing industry, and it's based on pretty much personnel stuff, personnel employment. If we had to downsize because of the fishing industry going and rank, which we hope it doesn't, it's been very good and very successful for the last few years. However, in the past, that has not been the case. And as it is now, we could not shrink our government, nor can we expand it based on this because of how much money we'd have to pay if we decided position that we just instituted. Recently, we added two new positions about last year, and if I had to downsize, those are the positions I would go look at. And yet, those are new positions, Pier 4 positions. According to how the law is written, we would still be obligated to pay funding if we don't meet the 2008 salary floor. I support Senate Bill 100 being passed. I think when the original bill was passed, everyone really didn't understand the ramifications of what's going on and what's happening to small governments. So I think as a small government, we do not have the opportunity to expand our contract as it is now with PERS. And I strongly urge you members to pass this because it's very, very much needed local governments. It doesn't affect the state or big governments as much as it does small governments like us, but it certainly affects us. Thank you, Mr. Chair, and Appreciate it.
Great. Thank you very much, Mr. Smith. Questions for Mr. Smith? Marv, thank you very much for your testimony this afternoon and for sticking around. We do have two folks in the gallery today. We have Mike Barnhill from the Department of Administration, just in case we have questions for Mr. Barnhill. And we also have Kathy Wasserman for the Alaska Municipal League. Ms. Wasserman? And I think you're it.
She's it.
You know the drill.
Yes, sir. Mr. Chairman, members of the committee, thank you. My name is Kathy Wasserman. I'm the executive director of the Alaska Municipal League. AML worked closely with the Senate during the crafting of SB 125. We appreciate everything that the Senate did to help us through the PERS situation, and we certainly don't take any of that lightly. However, this Senate Bill 100 will really help us right what we think is a wrong. It seems very strange to me that we should have rules on the books that keep government from operating in an efficient and an effective way, and that's exactly what this does. AML has been very active in House Bill 106, which is the Coastal Zone Management Bill. And as I was sitting in the hearing yesterday, I thought if Coastal Zone Management goes away, we have a bunch of communities that will now have to pay the past service cost on those Coastal Zone Management workers. And so that's going to be a huge impact on many of the communities within our state. COPS grants. Many of our municipalities rely on COPS grants to a great degree. And when those grants and if they go away, there will be some costs impacted by that. So, in short, I just want to say that we certainly hope you pass this bill. It can have a huge impact on communities, especially small ones, back when I was young and when Senator Egan was young. And we were both mayors together in my community of Pelican at some point when the community started to take a bit of a nosedive. I had to lay off two people, and both of those were a department in themselves. And I would have had to pay all of these service costs on those people, and I can't go back now and figure out what that would have been, but it certainly impacts your ability to make a smart and wise decision on who you should lay off in order to operate your government more efficiently and effectively. So with that.
Thank you, Ms. Wasserman. Questions for Ms.
Quick question.
Sarah Menard.
Thank you, Mr. Chairman. I'm certain, Senator Menard, for the record, I'm certain that embedded in the bill as you reviewed it, you knew about the small and the large employers and employees that were part of this termination study. Did any red flag go off at that time?
Senator Menard, through the chair, I rely on most of my PERS information on Larry Simmons and Michael Lamb, and I think all of us did not understand the ramifications on this. If you ask me too many PERS questions, you'll just get a blank stare. And then I turn quickly and look at Michael or Larry Simmons if he's in the room to help me, to help bail me out. But we did not see this. Had we seen it, I'm sure we would have said and done something then.
Okay. Thank you. Just to follow up, it appears to me to be such a debacle that I'm having a hard time wrapping my mind around that this wasn't figured out. So, and I do compliment the sponsor for bringing it forward, and hopefully we can clean it up. Thank you.
Thank you.
Great. Thank you, Senator Menard. Further questions for Ms. Wasserman? Kathy, thank you very much for sticking around and testifying this afternoon. That completes public testimony on Senate Bill 100. We will be bringing this bill up.
Mr. Chair.
Senator Menard.
If you could indulge me, I would appreciate just bringing administration up here to just give a short.
Mr. Barnhill, if you can come forward, please.
I think we'd be amiss if we didn't do that.
Your name and affiliation for the record, please.
Thank you, Mr. Chair. Mike Barnhill, Deputy Commissioner, Department of Administration. And I'm here for questions, but maybe before I answer some questions, maybe I could offer a somewhat different perspective on the issue. You've heard a lot from the folks in the municipalities. And by offering a differing perspective, I don't mean in any way to denigrate their concerns. The state retirement systems have a big unfunded liability. We learned of the unfunded liability in 2003. At that point in time, it was just over $4 billion. That's PERS and TERS combined. Today, it's approximately $10 billion. Now, prior to the passage of SB 125 in 2008, roughly speaking, in the PERS system, the responsibility for that liability was allocated roughly 50-50 between the state of Alaska and the other participants in the PERS system. There's approximately 156 employers. So 50-50, 50% of the liability was the responsibility of the state of Alaska's employer, and 50% of the liability was the responsibility of the remaining 155 PERS employer participants. What SB 125 did was essentially reallocate the responsibility for that by capping the total amount that that municipal employers have to pay to the PERS system at 22%. Now, the unfunded liability is a zero-sum game. If the municipal employers are not paying essentially what amounts to a mortgage payment, then the state has to pay that. And that's essentially what happened in SB 125, is that responsibility was shifted from the municipalities to the state general fund. And since the passage of SB 125, we're closing in on the general fund picking up approximately $1 billion worth of payments to the PERS system on behalf of the municipal employers. I think it's really important to understand that whenever one party does not pay into the system, somebody else has got to pay it. And under SB 125, that's the state general fund. Now, I appreciate Mr. Lamb saying that they're not trying to skirt their responsibility and they're paying their fair share under SB 125. But I think the bottom line is if the effect of this bill is going to shift some costs to the state general fund. And we'll be submitting a fiscal note at some point. I just got, literally while I was sitting here, a letter from the state's actuaries describing what the fiscal impact is. Now, I made a presentation to Senate Finance a few weeks ago in which we identified the history of the termination study issue to date. And I've brought copies for the committee. But in 2010, there were five terminations. Each one, and this is data from the state's actuary, Buck Consultants, each study cost $2,500. The one-time termination costs that are contemplated by the statute ranged from a low of $10,364 to a high of $21,373. And so I guess I would just, as in by way of offering a differing perspective to the committee, just suggest to you that in the context where the state general fund is going to pay relatively soon $1 billion on behalf of the PERS municipal employers to the PERS system, these are relatively small costs. Now, I've had discussions with both Mr. Lamb, Mr. Simmons, Senator Pascvan. I hear and I understand the concerns about employers wanting to be nimble and to have flexibility, and I think those are legitimate concerns, and we're certainly willing to continue those discussions and see if we can arrive at some solution to this that achieves fairness to the system without shifting undue costs to the state, but still solves some of the flexibility issues. You've heard today that there is a situation where there can be unfair double counting of salaries. We've discussed this with the Department of Law. The Department of Law has advised that we can address this through a regulation project. That regulation project is underway, and we hope to have that on the books relatively soon. I don't believe, and I'm not sitting here going to tell you, that that's going to solve all of Mr. Lamb or Mr. Simmons' concerns, but we think it goes at least partway to satisfying some of the concerns while still maintaining fairness to the system as a whole and to the state. And so with that, Mr. Chair, I'd be happy to answer any questions.
Great. Thank you, Mr. Barnhill. And not bad after just saying that you'd be available for questions.
Sorry.
Senator Pascvan.
Sure. Mr. Barnhill, do you agree that Senate Bill 100 does not in any way lessen the salary floor set in 2008?
Through the chair, no, it does not.
Okay. And you agree that the municipalities and school districts potentially are at risk because by accepting grants, for example, police grants?
At risk, through the chair, no, I don't think they're at risk. They can accept whatever grants they want. They can hire whomever they want. The issue becomes, and this whole issue of flexibility, that if they terminate those positions when the grant runs out, that potentially triggers a termination study requirement under current law.
Do you believe that there might be a connection between the possibility of the lack of employment at the end of a grant, and that affects the decision-making at the beginning as to whether you would even accept the grant? Do you follow that logic?
Through the chair, I think there's a number of considerations. And as I said at the outset, I'm not here to denigrate those concerns. I see the concern. It's an issue of trying to balance the tensions that are inherent in this issue.
On a yes or no basis, is the state of Alaska subject to a termination study process?
You know, that's an interesting question. And if I could get a lifeline from Ms. Lee, who's sitting behind me on that one. Before I get that, the bottom line is, under the cost-shifting rubric that I talked about, any additional costs that the system incurs under SB 125, the state general fund is going to pick up. So whether it is or it isn't, ultimately, if the state terminates a class of employees and there's costs to the system that are associated with that, ultimately the state general fund will pay for those. But
so you don't have an answer.
Can I get one?
No, I'm just saying you don't have – you were talking, but that's not the answer to the question.
Okay.
Mr. Barnhill, you can call your lifeline.
All right. Thank you.
You have permission.
Could he pass? Could we get those papers to him? Yeah.
And if you can give your name and affiliation for the record, please.
My name is Kathy Lee, and I am the Acting Deputy Director for the Division of Retirement and Benefits. And in reference to the question of why the state of Alaska does not have to have a termination study, under per statutes 3935.120, the state must mandatorily participate in PERS. Participation by all poly subs or school districts is voluntary. They can join. Now, the state of Alaska has no participation agreement, and all of the termination statutes that are in 600 through 630, I believe, refer to changes to a participation agreement. It refers to the voluntary participation of the political subdivisions or school districts. When the state of Alaska makes changes or when it reduces employees, while it may not have a termination study, while it may not have to amend an agreement, it still has to pay the liability. So no liability is shifting to any of the other employers because of the state's personnel actions. The state pays them itself.
Great. Thank you very much, Ms. Lee, for being a lifeline.
Thank you.
Questions for either Mr. Barnhill or Ms. Lee, as long as they're both at the table? Great. Thank you very much for testifying. And we will continue discussions on Senate Bill 100 at a future meeting. Senator Pasquin?
Mr. Chair, if I could make a statement that I know that we've received, for example, from the city of Nome, a resolution saying that they support Senate Bill 100 and that there are other municipality and school districts around the state, and we would request that they promptly submit those letters to you as the chair so that those can be distributed so that this committee can promptly act and timely act on this very important issue facing all of our municipality and school districts across the state.
Great. Thank you, Senator Pasquin. Further questions? Again, Mr. Lamb, thank you very much for presenting the bill for Senator Pasquin. And we have one more bill that we will be hearing.
Excuse me, Mr. Chair. Could he pass those out for us before he leaves?
Yes, Mr. Barnhill, if you can pass those out. I'm sorry. I apologize. Mr. Chair, do you think you can get it done in 7 minutes?
I believe so. I believe most of the committee has already heard.
Next is House Bill 13, Workers' Compensation Medical Fees. And again, it has a further referral to finance. Mr. Chair, welcome to Senate Labor and Commerce.
Oh, thank you, Chairman Egan, and I'd like to thank the committee also for hearing the bill today. For the record, my name is Kurt Olson, House District 33, and House Bill 13, Medical Services Fee Schedule, is a bill that is been worked on probably for about the last 4 years. It made it through both bodies last year and suffered from the 90-day disease at the end of session. Almost made it, but it's back. What this bill would do would be update our workers' compensation medical fee schedule. It hasn't been updated for a long time. The current schedule died on December 31st and was extended by the governor by an emergency regulation and will expire again on June 30th of this year. I don't believe we can afford to let it expire again. Our current schedule is missing over 2,000 service codes. I believe we have a total of 7,000 now that are covered under this bill. The new schedule would take into account consideration for geographic areas and the services provided, and we'll be using a national database that is considered to be accurate by the people that are using it at this point in time. And I do have Linda Hall with me, the Director of the Division of Insurance, who is extremely familiar with this. And if I still have 3 minutes left, and with the indulgence of the committee, I could bring her up for more detailed questions than I could probably answer.
Chair Olson,
I sure hope she's behind me.
She is. No, she's right behind you, and she was smiling, sort of. And we do have one person signed up to testify, but
besides Linda.
Besides Linda, Ms. Hall, if you can come forward, please. Thank you, Mr. Chair.
Thank you, Mr. Chairman. Linda Hall, Director of the Division of Insurance. I've never done anything in 3 minutes, so I'll try very
hard. Okay, today's number one.
Okay. I believe Representative Olson gave some of the history of this bill. The medical services, the fee schedule, was inadvertently omitted in 2004 legislation. Since that time, we have kept that fee schedule in place and merely made CPI increases to that schedule, which has resulted in the missing of approximately 2,000 procedure codes. There are in your packet some charts that I'm not going to spend time with today, but I would hope that you look at. It shows the medical benefits cost in Alaska is 75% of the system cost compared to 58% system cost countrywide. Shows the cost per case in Alaska of $37,000 as compared to countrywide $27,000. The point of those charts is to show you how high the medical costs are in Alaska, which have resulted in, for a number of years, Alaska having the highest workers' compensation costs in the country. I was really pleased this year we slipped to number two. Not a huge gain, but it's better than being number one in this particular instance. We don't often say that. Generally, we're looking at this bill. It provides a base fee schedule not to exceed usual, reasonable, and customary fees as established by the board. And I think, as Rep. Olson pointed out, the fee schedule will be based on a credible profile of billed charges that are constructed on geographical areas. So there is an area in this state that each section, there are three, work they're called geozips, geographical zip codes. So it's really based on Alaska billed charges and different zones. The only vendor we are aware of at this time is called Ingenix, and they take billed charges. They have a large database, and they construct a code for us. And with that, I would stop and take any questions that you might have of me.
Thank you, Director Hall. And again, we will be hearing this piece of legislation at a future date as well. Director, thank you very much. And also recognize Conrad Jackson of Representative Olson's staff is available. Did you have anything to provide?
Mr. Chairman, I believe the chairman and Linda Hall covered everything.
Great, thank you. We do have Misty Steed on off-net from Cornell Corporation. Ms. Steed?
Yes.
Yes.
Hi. Seed with Corvell Corporation in Anchorage, and I've worked quite extensively on some of these programs with the Medical Services Review Committee and on specifically on the fee schedule. My company is a company that services and does bill review for some of the employers in town, and specifically speaking to this fee schedule, I just wanted to say that, you know, we are definitely in support of what Linda's doing and what's been proposed, because if the fee schedule does not pass, the biggest fear here is that the employer not be able to afford its workers' compensation in the future, and the rates would increase due to medical expenses if this fee schedule is not in place. So I just wanted to throw that out there.
Great. Thank you very much, Ms. Steed, for your testimony. Questions from the committee? Great. Again, Misty, thank you for sticking around and providing testimony. And, again, we will be not necessarily taking public testimony, but we will be bringing up House Bill 13 at a future date very soon. Again, Mr. Chair, Representative Olson, thank you very much for attending. Director Hall, thank you. And With nothing further to come before the committee, we are adjourned at 2:21.